Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Jim Clapper spent 50 years in service of this country, first in military intelligence and then moving up the chain to director of national intelligence. He's served during some of the most sensitive challenges we've faced in recent history, including the 2016 election when the intelligence community uncovered evidence of Russian interference in our election. Now he's a passionate advocate for confronting the Russian challenge and getting to the bottom of what happened in 2016 and has drawn the constant ire of President Trump and his supporters. Jim Clapper just published a book called Facts and Fears, Hard Truths from a Life in Intelligence, and he sat down with me recently on a visit to the University of Chicago's Institute of Politics. Jim Clapper, it's so good to have you here. I know you're on a national tour now. Surprisingly to you, you say.
Yeah.
I told you that when I first made your acquaintance when I was an aide to the president, we were in some meeting together, and I would have said you were the least likely guy to be doing a national book tour or becoming a television personality. But events have thrust you into that place.
Well, first, David, thanks for having me. It's great to be here. And I would have agreed with you had you said that to me. And what brought me here? Well, I've seen a lot of bad things in 50 plus years in intelligence, but never anything that upset me as much as watching what the Russians did in the run-up to our 2016 election. And I decided after that that I'd been urged by people to write a book, mainly just to record the living through 50 years of intelligence community history. But the real catalyst for putting aside my fears, to draw a line from the book, was that. And I decided it was actually out of sense of duty, I think, more than anything, to convey what I learned as much as I could to as much of the public that was interested and would pay attention.
Which turns out to be a lot of people are interested in this, as they should be. They're also interested in you. And I want to start with a little bit of your own personal history, because you came by intelligence.
Genetically.
Genetically, yes. Yeah, you're not the first intelligence officer in your family.
Right. My dad was a signal intelligence officer for his 28 years in the Army, and starting World War II, he served during Korea and then in Vietnam. In fact, coincidentally, we were together in Vietnam. Our tours just coincidentally overlapped by 7 months, an unusual circumstance.
Yeah.
And I always tell people, if your dad's still alive, give him a hug, because I didn't really appreciate until I wrote this book the tremendous impact and influence my dad had on me, and whatever success I've been fortunate and been blessed to have is really due to his influence.
Well, tell me about signal intelligence and what your dad, what drew him to that. He was drafted in World War II.
He was drafted and went to officer candidate school, and you know, when the war ended, most everybody demobilized, took off the uniform, and he, for whatever reason, got caught up in the work of signal intelligence, and that.
Explain what that is for those who don't know.
Profoundly shrank after World War II. Well, basically, what signal intelligence is the collection, interception of communications, messages, not necessarily intended for you as a recipient. And the purpose is to glean and useful intelligence. In World War II, it was may have been the heyday for signal intelligence because it was kept very secret, and it had a huge impact on the outcome of the war because of the great insight we gained by breaking into both Japanese and German communications. And
anyone saw the great film, The Imitation Game, and the British breaking of the Nazi codes would be.
Well, there's a story about, you know, the Enigma machine, and of course Bletchley Park,
yes,
which
right.
was that's actually kind of the origin of the very special intelligence relationship that yet pertains between the United Kingdom and the United States, and it goes back to that early. Those dark days of World War II and the tremendous impact that our cryptologic people and the things they were able to do in both theaters of war, both against the Germans and the Japanese.
And he became deeply interested in
this. He did, and decided to stay in the Army and continue. And of course, that was kind of tough in the peacetime Army after World War II. It shrank, and pay wasn't very good. My dad, I think he was a first lieutenant for about 6 years, something like that. So it was tough doing it. So he was clearly captured by it and dedicated to it. And somehow over the years, that got passed on to me.
You moved around quite a bit, as military families do.
We did. My mother and I were on the first, one of the first boatloads of dependents to go anywhere after World War II, and it was kind of primitive in those days. And I remember my dad's duty station was in Asmara, Eritrea, on the east of Africa. Very small U.S. Army SIGINT post there, and so it took us 8 weeks to go from Fort Wayne, Indiana, where my mother and I were, to Asmara, and we spent 2 weeks in the Brooklyn Navy Yard while they tried to figure out what shots to give us. Then we finally sailed on an old troop ship and went to Leghorn, Italy, and we're sailing in the harbor and hit a mine left over from the war, which blew a rudder off the ship. And I still have very distinct memory of being hustled up on deck with my mother and lifeboats being lowered, and I had a huge life jacket on, way too big for me, that my mother was holding on to.
So anyway, were you scared or
yeah,
or
I was pretty frightened. My mother was trying to be cool about it, but she had to have been very frightened by it. But the crew reacted, and the ship didn't sink. They towed us into the harbor and repaired the rudder, and we went on and eventually landed in Alexandria, Egypt, and found our way down to Asmara, Eritrea.
I read interesting. You lived in Philly. And you cracked the code on public safety communications on your TV set.
Yeah, this the story. I was 12 years old. This is my line here. This is when I first knew I was going to be an intelligence officer. So we were on a change of duty stations. We left Japan, northern Japan, on the northernmost island, Hokkaido, in the summer of 1953. And my dad was being assigned to Fort Devens, Massachusetts. So typically in many military families, certainly in ours, my parents would drop my sister and me off at one of the grandparents, go ahead to the next duty station, find a place to live, get set up, you know, unpack the household goods and all that, and then come back as a retrieve us. So that's what they did in the summer of 1953. We'd just come back from Japan, and so they dropped us at my grandparents' in Philadelphia. And so the standard line for grandparents, of course, is to spoil grandchildren. I'm doing that myself now. I have four grandchildren.
I applaud that as a grandparent.
So the big thing in the day was television, which was a big novelty. And my grandparents had a television in their house. We didn't have television in Japan in those days and in the early 50s. So this was really a novelty to me. So they allowed me to stay up as late as I wanted, watch as much television as I wanted. It was great. So one Friday night, I watched a movie, and the movie ended, and I was going to do the equivalent of what we'd say today is surfing, except in those days you had to go up and actually turn the dial on the TV. And there's only four channels. So I was turning the channel between Channel 4 and Channel 5 in Philadelphia, and I heard talking on the television. And no picture. And that was strange. So I just stood there for about 10 or 15 minutes, holding on to the selector dial, keeping it between Channel 4 and 5. And I finally figured out it was the Philadelphia Police Department dispatcher. Well, in those days in Philadelphia, there's a lot of murder and mayhem on Friday and Saturday nights. So this is really interesting stuff, just to see how the police reacted to these calls for domestic disturbances and shootings and runaway kids and cars they're chasing and all that. It's just interesting.
More interesting than the other four
stations.
Interesting
to listen to it.
Yeah.
So I ran out to the kitchen. I got tired of holding it. I got some toothpicks and stuck the toothpick in the selector dial. So I guess I hacked my grandparents' TV set. So then the next night, I got a map of Philadelphia from my grandfather, city map. I started plotting out where the calls went. And then, you know how the police use 10 codes?
Yeah.
So I started listening to them, figuring out what they were. And I got a set of 3x5 cards. I guess that's, we'd call it metadata today. And I started keeping records on this. And so pretty soon, I could figure out just by the way they dispatched police cars, what the police district boundaries were. And I also figured out the high crime areas, and I figured out how the Philadelphia Police Department is organized and operated just by listening. And so I kept all these records, and I had my map and all that. So about 3 weeks later, my mom and dad come back to pick up my sister and me. And my dad just sort of casually made conversation. Said, well, hey, what have you been doing this summer? So I whip out my map and my 3x5 cards, and I gave him about a 20 or 30 minute discourse on the complete rundown on how the Philadelphia Police Department is organized and operated. And it was 65 years ago, but I'll never forget the expression on my dad's face. And he said, my God, I've raised my own replacement. So that's when I knew I was going to be an intelligence officer.
You, in reading your biography, it struck me that you tried very hard. There are a lot of people who tried hard not to get into the military. You tried very hard to get into the military. And in fact, you failed a physical exam because of a vision issue.
Right. I was fortunate enough that my dad had a friend in the Marine Corps, and they weren't quite so picky about visual acuity. And I had my left eye would not correct to 20/20. Pretty close, but not quite. So the Marines took me, and I enlisted in the Marine Corps on the 2nd of February, 1961, and then completed half their platoon leader course down at Quantico. I really did want to specialize in intelligence, and I'd come back from Germany where I was living with my dad, who was assigned there, and I went to the University of Maryland and took Air Force ROTC because I could specialize in intelligence, and so that's what I did.
So let me ask you this. We've all heard the president's had a few things to say about you, and in fairness, you've had a few things to say about him as well. But does it bother you as someone who's spent so much of his life in service to the country and in uniform to have your patriotism challenged by a guy who avoided service in Vietnam for bone spurs?
Well, first of all, yes, it does. But I have to say that, speaking critically of a president as commander in chief, very difficult for me. Mm-hmm. I was raised to respect the office, and particularly as commander in chief. That's something
you met one, right? In your early years,
yes,
you had a brush with
President Kennedy.
President Kennedy.
President Kennedy, when I was at, I happened to be in a rope line once at Otis Air Force Base, Massachusetts, where I went to ROTC summer camp. And so he flew in, and they filed us out. All the ROTC cadets were in summer camp then, and I ended up in the rope line. And President Kennedy went, it was about eight of us, I think, in the front row, and he went and shook hands with each cadet. And I was about the sixth or seventh one in line, and his typical question was, what aircraft are you going to fly, since we're Air Force? And got to me, and what are you going to fly? And I said, I'm not going to fly. I want to be an intelligence officer. And he sort of did a double take, and he said something like, well, we need intelligence officers. And, you know, he kept on going. I'm sure he forgot about it, but I never forgot about it. It was quite inspirational.
But
the
you were saying that you were raised and trained to respect the commander in chief.
Exactly. And then, of course, when I served in the military for a total of 34 years, counting my Marine Corps reserve time and active duty in the Air Force, so it's just instinctive. It's just part of my being to want to support and respect the commander in chief. The president is commander in chief, and you know, with this president, it's a challenge. And I was asked once during a CNN interview when I got a bad tweet from President Trump, and I was asked, "Gee, doesn't that bother you?" I said, "No, it doesn't," and that in itself is a sad commentary. I remember distinctly when Sally Yates was ended up as the acting attorney general, and she and I appeared together for a Senate Judiciary Committee subcommittee chaired by Lindsey Graham. And the president tweeted that both Sally Yates and James Clapper choked during the hearing, which I don't think we did. But anyway, I remember thinking to myself, you know, if I had showed up at the Oval Office and President Obama had said to me, "Boy, you really choked on that hearing yesterday," I'd have been devastated. But this president, no.
Yeah, it just struck me that when I read how hard you fought to get into the Air Force and into the service, that it must particularly gall you to have your patriotism questioned.
Well,
and it isn't service yeah, question.
It isn't just me. It's others that mm-hmm. he's similarly.
Well, John McCain.
I mean, as private citizens, here's the president of the United States reaching out and attacking individuals just because they don't agree with him or they're not in the business of adulating him. It's very very unusual, very abnormal.
You had. Early in your career, supervisory responsibilities, and you've written about one of the things that you were called upon to do was to discharge service people who are homosexual.
Early on in my career, my first assignment after I went through technical training, I was at Kelly Air Force Base in San Antonio, and somebody decided to be a good career enhancing thing for me to learn a little bit about administering troops and, Article 15's non-judicial punishment, supervising the mess hall, inspecting barracks and the motor pool and all those kind of basic military things. And so one of the things I had to do was to discharge two airmen who were outed as homosexuals. And in the day, there was no choice. You were discharged automatically. And the best you could hope for was a general discharge, if not dishonorable. And I remember at the time, I was a first lieutenant. I was a cog in the big machine. Here's the rules and, process the paperwork. And I just remember then, this is, 1964, 65, what a waste that was and what an injustice it was. And sometime later on, I think I had a chance to atone for that, and the military has always been an institution of social change, and I think the graceful way the military openly accepted gays was a phenomenal achievement, and it speaks volumes about. What a great institution the military is for this country.
I was in the room, perhaps you were too, when President Obama signed an end to the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. And the person who got the biggest ovation in that room was Mike Mullen, the chairman
exactly.
of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It was really one of the most moving experiences
exactly.
I had when I was in Washington.
A tremendous example of non-combatant courage was Mike's statement, I think his own statement before, I think, the Senate Armed Services Committee, when he highlighted what a injustice it was to force people to hide their identities just so they could serve the country. And that was a brave and courageous thing. And I cite that quote, his exact quote, in my book. I
think
it was a tremendous act of leadership.
You went. You did two tours of duty in Vietnam. You flew 73 combat support missions in Laos and Cambodia. You and you rose quickly through the in the 80s through the intelligence community. In the early 90s, Dick Cheney, who was the Secretary of Defense, appointed you as head of the Defense Intelligence Agency. That was a rough go for you because you tried to reorganize the Defense Intelligence Agency in a way that conformed to what you thought was the emerging world and not the Cold War world on the theory that the Cold War had just ended.
Right.
But that wasn't well received.
No, it was not. And what occasioned that, the need to do something, was because we were enjoined by the Congress to reap the peace dividend after the fall of the wall, the collapse of the Soviet Union. You know, the general judgment was we don't need this huge military and we certainly don't need this big intelligence community. So we embarked on a period of about 7 or 8 years of reductions. And so what I determined early on was that the organization and structure, DIA, was not going to have enough people to populate it. So we had to do something else. The lesson learned there is if you're going to do a reorganization of big bureaucracy, you better get the buy-in of the people that are affected. And I didn't do such a great job of that. So I had to do another reorganization, undo the ill effects of the first one. And so as the older I've gotten, the less and less enamored I am of reorganizations as a way to cure issues that stem more from leadership or lack thereof than structure.
You left the military for a while, and then you got inveigled to come back. You probably thought you were done.
I did. I retired from the military, from the Air Force in September 95. 1995, and I was in industry, but basically working back for the intelligence community, and I served on the NSA advisory board for 4 years, and I did covert towers investigation and did some other things that retirees typically do back for the government. And then in the summer of 2001, out of the blue, I got a call asking me if I would be willing to come back and serve as director of what was then the National Imagery Mapping Agency. And what I'd learned during my sojourn out of the government was that I just didn't get the psychic income I got from public service. The money was great, but somehow making the owner of the company I was working for richer just didn't motivate me too much. So I jumped at the chance and stayed with NEMA, which transformed into the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, which it is today, and was there almost 5 years.
And you were there during a pretty eventful time because 9/11 happened, and what followed was the war in Iraq, and the intelligence community came under siege for that.
Right.
Properly so, do you think?
Absolutely. And I say that, David, because my fingerprints were on the infamous National Intelligence Estimate of October 2002, which addressed weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And of course, as we painfully learned later, there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So it was a terrible mistake. What I like to point out, though, is the intelligence community is a learning organization, and we went to work immediately after that to improve processes to preclude a recurrence of that. That NIE, and NIEs are at the apex of the pecking order for intelligence products, and they typically always go to the president and other senior policymakers. So they're important, and they do have impact. And then NIE was used by the administration, which kind of wanted that message, mm-hmm. As a justification for invading Iraq. So it just shows the implications if intelligence doesn't get it right.
And you know that the charge by those who opposed the war was that the intelligence was essentially manufactured to support the political result.
Well, I wouldn't say manufactured as much as it shows a negative example of the bad impacts of groupthink. The major change we made, though, David, that which prevails yet today is examining more critically the veracity of the sources used to generate the analytic product. And we didn't do that. And a lot of the intelligence, that key intelligence in that document, was generated by a bad source, a bad human intelligence source. And so the practice instituted, which I followed during the 6.5 years I was DNI, was that every time we convene a meeting of the National Intelligence Board, which is the senior representatives of all 16 components of the intelligence community, to vet and approve NIEs, the very first thing on the meeting agenda is to review the sources. If you have one report from your organization that's footnoted in that national intelligence estimate, then the agency head or senior representative has to certify the veracity of that reporting. So there's a lot more discipline now in assessing the credibility of sources. And if we learn later they go bad, we pull that out of those reports. So that was among many changes we made to strengthen the process, was, I think, the key one.
Looking back at that, how much did that decision shape the future of that region, the events that we've seen since 2003, and how would history have been different had the intelligence been right and there not been this incursion?
It's hard to know, but presumably, at least that justification for invading Iraq wouldn't have been there. Maybe it would have been invaded anyway. I don't know, but at least the intelligence wasn't the excuse or justification for it. So, if there weren't an invasion, whether it's almost an imponderable about how things would have been. Probably more stable. Mm-hmm. Maybe Arab Spring wouldn't have happened. I know there's a whole. It's hard to know, but there's a whole bunch of a sequence of events that may not have happened or would have taken a different course than they did as a result of our invading Iraq.
How much time have you spent contemplating that episode?
Well, not just me personally, but I think institutionally, the intelligence community has contemplated that a lot. And of course, there was another commission, mm-hmm. That was stood up just to study weapons of mass destruction and reporting. And there were a number of, I think, 76 recommendations, something like that, they made to enhance, to improve intelligence, collection, analysis, and reporting on weapons of mass destruction. So, I, as I say, we try to be a learning organization even when it's forced on us.
I want to jump ahead to your tenure as DNI. You did a stint as Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence. You worked with Bob Gates in that role.
Yeah, Bob, we actually go back to when I served as Director of DIA, and then Bob was Director of CIA, and then dual hat as Director of Central Intelligence. And he's a friend and actually a mentor of mine. And it was he who asked me to come back when he became Secretary of Defense, just to finish the Bush term, which would have been about 19 months. And I asked a small favor of him. I said, you could probably ease this for me at home if you call my wife, which which he did. And then he recounted that in his book, which mm-hmm. was a little embarrassing. But anyway, the 19 months turned into 3.5 years because unprecedented thing happened when President Obama, a Democrat, asked Bob Gates, a Republican, to stay on as Secretary of Defense. Never happened before. And it was a great choice, a great decision. I great admiration, respect, and esteem for Bob Gates. So the 19 months that I promised my wife turned into 3.5 years. And I thought, well, and my plan was when Bob walked out the river entrance of the Pentagon, I was going to fall in about a millisecond later. And one day he summoned me to his office, and we had a little one-on-one meeting in April of 2010. And he said, we really need you to do this, the DNI. And I said, no. At the time, I was pushing 70 years old. Now I'm dragging it. And I, big thing was I did not want to go through another political confirmation as I had for Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, which was awful. It got prolonged. I was held, and I just hated it. So I didn't want to do that anymore. But when they run you in the Oval Office, and it was the first time I ever met President Obama, and you know, the commander-in-chief says, I need you to do this job. And, you know, I'm duty guy at heart. So I said, I'll give it a go. And so that turned into 6.5 years. Now I am definitely done.
Well, you never know. You never want to say never, General. You mentioned that Bob Gates was a Republican. Did you consider yourself a partisan in any way?
No, not really.
Voted in one way or the other?
I voted both ways. I voted, but I voted for Republican presidents and Democratic presidents. And I was the family environment I was brought up in was political neutrality. And
unusual in the military.
I don't think so. I think military serves the commander in chief, whoever it is. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of that sort of ethos that I grew up in. And, mm-hmm. and certainly that's what I adapted when I came into the military myself.
You, as head of DNI, and we should say that office came into being as a result of 9/11 to promote coordination among the 17 intelligence agencies. There were three things I want to ask you about, and then I want to get to where we are today in 2016. The first was Bin Laden, and just very briefly, what was that like making that call? Tom Dolan was here the other day, and we talked about this. President has said that he was very much reliant on the intelligence in making that decision.
I'll tell you, David, that was a tremendous, a courageous act, decision that President Obama made because for two reasons. We didn't have, you know, the intelligence we had was less than perfect. We did not have certitude that Osama bin Laden was in that compound. And I'll never forget the last meeting we had, and I'm sure Tom will recall this as well, which I think was on a Thursday. And the president went around the table, as he typically did, and asked everybody's thoughts on should we do it, and if so, how. And he got responses all over the map. There was not unanimity among his national security team. And we put a lot of discussion about a percentage of confidence, which to me is not very meaningful. It, in the end, it's all subjective judgment anyway. And I said that to him, and I said, for me, I am going to go with the analysts, the experts have been following this for years, and their assessment, their instinct really is they're sure he's there. And I also felt that we should do it with a raid as opposed to a standoff weapon, because you have thinking people on the ground that can make decisions given whatever the situation is.
Because part of it was you want to make sure that you did get him.
Well, that you got him, but also, I mean, part of the imponderable here was whether the Pakistanis would detect the raid, and they had a long way to fly from Afghanistan and back, and what their reaction might be, and would there be a hostile reaction? How in danger would our troops be, and all those kind of factors? And I just thought it was a very brave, courageous decision that the president made on less than perfect information and not unanimous advice from his advisors.
I want to ask you about Edward Snowden and that whole controversy, and you're blunt about this as well. That was that moment became a difficult one for you, not just because of all of the intelligence that was disgorged by Snowden, and I know that you don't buy into his motivations in doing it. You've called him a narcissist.
The major takeaway well, first of all, on Snowden himself, if he had limited what he had exposed only to so-called domestic intelligence, I could almost understand what he did.
In other words, making the case that there was been this broad collection of data that involved American citizens.
And although I think the portrayal of that program was profoundly exaggerated, and it became a big narrative that we in the government just could never defeat. But the fact is that he exposed so much else that had nothing to do with so-called domestic intelligence that had profoundly damaged our intelligence capability. And if you're a taxpayer, you're paying for the recovery from the damage that he's done. I will say, though, that the lesson learned here was the need for transparency. You know, the intelligence community needs to be more transparent. There's always an aura of mystery about the intelligence community and what the intelligence community and people in the intelligence community are doing. And that aura of mystery inherently gives rise to suspicion that we're doing something untoward, illegal, immoral, unethical, whatever. And unfortunately, history's replete.
Well, you lived through some of it. I mean, there were abuses of intelligence for political purposes.
During
Vietnam and during the Watergate period that led to the development of the FISA court.
And the Church Pike hearings, which led to the stand-up of the two oversight committees in the House in 1976 and the Senate in 77, I think. Mm-hmm. And those are a important fixture in the oversight of the intelligence community. And the problem is intelligence inherently cannot be fully open and transparent because of the nature of the work.
Right.
It's not like a Department of Agriculture or Department of Commerce, because most of what they do is completely transparent. Well, yeah. it can't be that way.
I guess. I'm not sure anybody knows.
Maybe
what
not
they
anymore,
do either,
but it used to be. Maybe that's not a good example. But intelligence can't be. So that's why there's a double burden, extra heavy burden placed on members of the House and Senate, respectively, who are on those two committees, because they have to be proxies or surrogates for the rest of the public. To represent them, mm-hmm. to ensure that what the intelligence community is doing is legal, ethical, and moral. And that works when they are bipartisan. And when they're not, it doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah.
One other thought, if I might add here, as desirable as transparency is in the interest of gaining the faith, trust, and confidence of the American public, transparency is a two-edged sword. So the adversaries go to school on that very same transparency. So there's always a risk-gain judgment that intelligence people have to make about, should we expose this capability or explain this program in the interest of confidence of the American public and trust that we're doing the right thing, or do we protect it so that we can continue it because of the valuable intelligence we gain from this particular source or method?
You were exposed to criticism because of the hearings surrounding Snowden, and a question that Senator Wyden asked, in which he said, does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans? And you said, no, sir, it does not. Yeah. And you write about this, you've spoken about this.
I do.
And with some regret.
I do regret it. That statement you just quoted was at the end of a longer discourse preamble that he spoke about. This was at the end of a hearing in March of 2013, and the subject of the hearing is worldwide threat. So we'd already gone about 2.5 hours on that subject, and then he brought this up. And I simply wasn't thinking about what Senator Wyden was asking about. What he was asking about, I made a big mistake, but I didn't lie. There's a big difference. But what he was asking about was the limited storage of telephony business records metadata governed by what was then Section 215 of the Patriot Act. What I was thinking about was another program, Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, Amendments Act, excuse me, is awkwardly worded, which governs the collection on non-U.S. persons overseas, ergo my attempt at an explanatory comment, amplification comment, that if such collection happened on U.S. persons, it would be inadvertent. Well, that comment, by the way, makes no sense in the context of Section 215, which at least to me proves I wasn't even thinking about it. And by the way, had I been thinking about what Senator Wyden was asking me about,
you wouldn't have answered.
I'd have still been in a bad place because at the time the program was classified.
Mm-hmm. And this was an open session.
Yes, this is an open session. So I've probably been up to the Hill for 20 or 25 years testifying in hearings, both open and closed. I've answered probably dozens of hearings, answered maybe hundreds, thousands of questions, and always endeavor to be truthful and straight about them. So, gee, just for a change of pace, on this one question, I think I'll lie just to be different.
Yeah.
And by the way, do it on live television in front of one of my oversight committees, which on its face to me is incredulous. So, yes, I made a mistake. But I didn't lie, and I do regret it.
You began this conversation by talking about what the Russians had done. Let's talk about that. And when did it become apparent to you what was happening in the 2016 election?
You know, I've been asked that question a lot, like, when did the light bulb come on? What was the exact moment when you knew this was different? Because the Russians have a long history of interfering in elections, theirs and other people's. And it goes back to at least the 60s, you know, the heyday of the Cold War, where the Russians were trying to influence our elections. But never as direct and aggressive and as multifaceted as what they did in 2016. And it sort of gradually unfolded. I think in the summer and fall of 16 is when it really, when we got more information from more sources, we began to understand the magnitude of what they were doing. It was had a visceral impact on me. I've seen a lot of bad stuff in 50 plus years in intelligence, but nothing like this. It really shook me because this was intended to undermine the very fundamental pillars of our system.
And you become more and more definitive over time. You believe not only what the IC said at the time, which is that, in January, that this was an operation that was meant to defeat Clinton and elect Trump. You believe that it actually tipped the election.
I do. And I have to point out, David, whenever this topic comes up, that just to reemphasize that the intelligence community assessment that we produced, published on the 6th of January in unclassified form, did not render a judgment on whether the Russian meddling had any impact on the outcome of the election. So it's important that I say that, that was the official, because the intelligence community doesn't have the charter or the resources to do that. However, break, as a private citizen, having a pretty good understanding of the massive effort that the Russians mounted, the diversity of sources and social media that they used, and the number of American voters that they reached with their message, that to me, and then if you consider that with the fact that the election turned on 80,000 votes or so in three states,
yes,
it is stretches credulity in my mind to think that all of that had no impact on the election. In fact, I believe, because it didn't have to be that many votes, that the Russians swung it.
You look. You've obviously.
But that I have to add. That's a. What
no,
I would
no.
Call
you're well
opinion.
Disclaimed here.
Informed opinion.
You've looked at what they did. I think somewhere I read you also said that what they did was very much in concert with what the Trump campaign was doing.
What I point out in the book is the striking parallelism between the themes and the things that the Trump campaign was saying and doing and what the Russians were saying and doing. It was almost like an echo chamber, particularly on the subject of Hillary Clinton, her alleged scandals, her alleged maladies, both mental and physical. And it was striking parallelism. I don't allege collusion. I don't know that. I didn't know it before I left.
They could have just watched and observed what the Trump campaign was doing.
But it's just striking.
So you guys didn't know about this June 6th meeting.
We did not. Yeah. Which, thus proving that we didn't surveil Trump Tower, as the president alleged.
What is your reaction to that meeting? You had Republican apparatchiks coming and offering material on Hillary Clinton, whether or not they produced it. And you had people in the room, Paul Manafort in particular, who were pretty sophisticated about how the Russians operated. What do you conclude from that?
Well, it's hard to say. I can't tell whether this was kind of the old radio show, Ted Mack's original amateur hour. They just didn't know what they were doing. Or they did know.
But wouldn't a guy like Manafort, who had such experience in that with the Russians,
which would mean an intent to collude? Now, collusion, obviously, as we all know, is not—that's not a legal thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed to me that they were interested. The campaign was interested in help from whatever quarter it came, whether it was the Russians or UAE or anybody else, and it kind of contravenes our laws with respect to elections. So there, it would appear to me as a layman, not a lawyer, mm-hmm. that there was certainly an intent to collude. And if the Russians, if the Russian interlocutors at that meeting came across with dirt, so-called, on Hillary Clinton, it looks to me they would have accepted it.
By the way, the
president himself as a candidate exhorting the Russians to go out and find the 30,000 missing emails is, again, I thought, a public exhortation to collude.
What did you see? What did you think when you saw that?
Well, I thought it was awful. I just thought it was just completely inappropriate for a candidate for the office of President of the United States to call on an adversary to help him publicly, to help him with his campaign.
You know Mike Flynn.
I do.
You were actually a colleague and a supporter of his appointment as head of the Defense Intelligence Agency. What do you make of what's happened since?
Well, first, it's only appropriate to acknowledge and salute Mike's long service in the Army. He's a great military intelligence officer. I helped officiate at his promotion ceremony, the 3 stars in the Women's Memorial, a wonderful ceremony. And he worked for me for about 11 months, his first job as a 3-star. And I supported him to be appointed as director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, a job I'd had much earlier. Things didn't work out for a number of reasons. Both Dr. Mike Vickers, who was my successor as Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, who also has a responsibility for the intelligence agencies embedded in DOD, Department of Defense, and he had issues with Mike Flynn, and as did I. And we just mutually agreed that we need to shorten his term.
None of those went to suspected ties to Russia.
No. This had more to for me. It was just sort of management issues. He was having a negative impact on the employees, and I was concerned about the
so what provoked him? Do you think?
Well, I think he took it pretty gracefully, and we had a wonderful send off for him the following summer of 14. I surmise. I don't know because I have not had much contact with him. He became an angry man, and I think it ate at him that his time was curtailed, which is kind of sad. I mean, the Mike Flynn I watched at the Republican convention was not the Mike Flynn I had known. He's a different person.
And what about the Mike Flynn who's now pled guilty to lying to the FBI?
Well, I feel bad for him. I just think it's in a way it's a tragedy.
Hillary Clinton is someone you work very closely with. What was your assessment of her?
I thought she was excellent in her job. My observations of her were primarily just sitting next to her in the Situation Room. She always came to meetings prepared. She was thoughtful, had tremendous work ethic. So on a personal level, I was I admired her.
And what did you think about the whole email controversy? Well, as someone who's dealt with classified information,
I thought it was unfortunate lapse in judgment on somebody's part. We, the IC, got involved in that because of the referral of a sampling of emails from the department, State Department Inspector General to the Intelligence Community Inspector General. And that was the predicate, actually, for the beginning of the FBI investigation on those emails. And it was just it was a very bad practice, security practice, to do that. And I think it's very regrettable.
The dossier that has now become famous,
yes,
the Steele dossier, what... It's now been dismissed by the president and his supporters because of the salacious material in there as a smear job paid for by Democrats that was the impetus for the FISA warrant on Carter Page. How much of that dossier rings true to you?
Well, first of all, another point I always have to make here, we did not use the dossier, which is actually a compendium of 17 separate memos. We did not use it as a source for the intelligence community assessment. Some things in the dossier were corroborated in our intelligence community assessment. And other things have been corroborated since. But we didn't use it because we couldn't validate the second, third order collection sources that were used to compile.
That's the point you were making earlier about sources.
So I felt, and the four of us, that is John Brennan, then director of CIA, Jim Comey, director of the FBI, and then Admiral Mike Rogers, who just retired as director of NSA, our general sense was that we owed it to the president-elect to tell him that this thing was out there, because our understanding was it was widely held throughout by the media. At least two members of Congress had it. So we felt as a duty to warn that we should tell the president-elect about this. Jim Comey was concerned about the potential counterintelligence implications.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Russians are big on what they call compromat, their acronym for compromising material, whether it's real or contrived, and that how they might try to use that to leverage or influence the president. And Jim felt strongly about he should be warned about that. So in the no good deed goes unpunished department, we did that and tried to be as discreet about it as possible. So we necked down to just Jim and President-elect Trump at Trump Tower, and that's when
so as not to embarrass him.
Yeah, exactly, and to keep it as discreet as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, since then, there have been all kinds of criticism about our doing that, but some of what is in those memos has been validated, has been
corroborated. And some of the compromising...
But not the... No, some of the to be sure of the salacious stuff, no.
Let's leave the salacious stuff aside. One of the things that was asserted in that compendium of memos that was the so-called dossier was a suggestion that there were financial levers that the Russians had on the president that could be used to compromise him. What do you say about that?
Well, I mean, they have had dealings and attempted dealings with the Russians, I'm given to understand that the Trump organization turned to the Russians for financing, bank loans, and this sort of thing. But I don't know any of the details, and I certainly didn't know any of them.
Would that be compromising if
they could be? It could be.
If they're involved in money laundering.
You know, there are all kinds of theories about... why is it that the president refuses to be critical of the Russians or particularly of Vladimir Putin? And of course, that's one explanation. Maybe he has something on him. I don't know. Or there's a financial entanglement or entanglements, plural, that he doesn't want exposed. Or as Mike Hayden suggests, it's just a question of incompetence. Or President Trump is just taken with strongmen, with autocrats. He admires them, or some combination thereof. I don't know.
What do you make of the president's? I mean, you have been a frequent visitor to his Twitter account, as we mentioned earlier. He has been brutal on the on all those who were involved in this probe, suggesting that it was a politically motivated probe. How do you react to that personally, and what impact does it have on the IC, on the Department of Justice, on the FBI?
Well, it's not a good thing when the president is berating and demeaning these important institutions of ours. I mean, I think right now intelligence community is not exactly in the crosshairs, and most of the president's wrath is focused on Department of Justice and the FBI. And it's clear to me. In fact, you know, Rudy Giuliani acknowledged as much Sunday that the objective here is, in the court of public opinion, undermine the investigation, undermine the credibility of Bob Mueller and his team. And that's not good for the long-term health of our institutions in this country.
What about the fundamental underlying argument that this was all a contrivance?
Well,
I mean, I ask you this.
David, I've often thought about, you know, if it hadn't been for President Obama tasking us to do that intelligence community assessment, I wonder what would have happened, because that was a catalyst for a whole series of events that are yet unfolding, to include the establishment of the special counsel. It all started with that intelligence community assessment documenting the Russian meddling. And it was only because President Obama told us to do it, and also do it before the end of his administration, and put out as much of it as possible on unclassified. So the key judgments that were rendered in the unclassified version are identical to the key judgments in the highly classified version. And the substantiation for which was overwhelming. Now, the business about the extent to which the president or any of his campaign were colluding with the Russians, all that, I don't know. I still don't. And that's why it's very important that somehow there be a resolution to this, that the Mueller investigation, one way or another, clear this up and remove this cloud over the nation.
But as we sit here, the president and his supporters on television in Congress have really raised the ante in terms of coloring the Mueller investigation as a political witch hunt, is the word that the president likes to use. I wonder, because you are a student of techniques that regimes use, that administrations use, do you see things in here that are reminiscent of other?
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is regrettably it comports with Russian tradecraft, and this is a case study in the use, skillful use, I might add, and effective use, because I think what he's doing is sticking in a court of public opinion, which is regrettable. But this is a patented Russian, and before that, Soviet technique. And the whole objective, sow doubt, discord. So that, you know, you can't get to truth. It could be this, it could be that. And that, this is what the Russians exploited, by the way, in a campaign. And they're very good at it. And I think this is exactly the strategy that the president and his team are taking.
What are the implications of that for our democracy?
Well, they're not good because the concern I've had throughout all this is the jeopardy to our institutions, which are fragile. I mean, there's not much, when you think about it, there's not much difference between any institution operating in a democracy and the same institution operating in an autocratic environment, and I think the president is compromising that, and is compromising these crucial institutions, like a free press, like an independent judiciary, like an independent FBI, and an intelligence community that will tell truth to power even if the power doesn't listen to the truth, and these are important institutions in our country, and they're under assault, and both internally, and then the Russians, of course, they're exploiting that. And we, unfortunately, the nation is a ripe target.
You, let me just finish here. You are a student of technology as it's applied in these ways. I mean, you've watched the development of these tools. How much does the does technology itself and the ability to wage cyber war and the ability to manipulate social media and so on, how much does that put democracies in jeopardy for manipulation?
Well, a lot. I will tell you that the biggest single force for change in the intelligence community has been technology. That is what has brought about huge change just in the intelligence community. And we've gone from a situation where there's consistent dearth of information to an abundance of information. And the problem today, because information is so ubiquitous, and there's this constant volume of it at very high velocities, and this leads to, I think, sloppiness in journalism, the 24-hour news cycle thing, and our worship of sound bites, because there's so much information, you have to move on to the next event. And of course,
we should point out so we both participate in that environment, but
yeah, exactly. And it's so ripe for manipulation, where if people with nefarious purposes in mind, whether foreign or domestic, can exploit that and create uncertainties, make it seem as though you cannot arrive at truth because we have alternative facts, or truth is relative, to use, quote, a couple phrases. And that's very dangerous to a democracy, where truth and facts, empirical evidence, are crucial. Those are fundamental underpinnings to an effective and true democracy, in my opinion.
In addition to Russia, there are some really emergent issues in the world. China, longstanding, and right now North Korea. As we sit here, the president may or may not be headed to Singapore on June 12th to sit down with Kim Jong-un, an unprecedented event, an American president sitting down with a North Korean leader. What's your analysis of the situation?
Well, first, this is one case where I actually agreed with something President Trump has done, and I thought his letter to Kim Jong-un was appropriate, and it elicited, it got the right response, a conciliatory response from Kim Jong-un. So I do think they should have the summit. I think, though, we should not have great expectations for a summit, but I think there'd be great value in gripping and grinning and meeting and greeting and all that, but not to expect the grand bargain on denuclearization, because that won't happen. I think it would be a win-win, mutually reciprocal on both parts, to establish a regular mechanism for communicating back and forth, which could serve to maybe restrict some of the bellicose rhetoric that we've seen publicly in the past. What would really be useful in this case, and our president's not known for this, would be for him to go on a listening tour. I think it would be extremely useful to hear from the horse's mouth, first time ever, you know, North Korea is a family-owned country, and get from the horse's mouth, what is it, the question that I'd like to hear answered, what would it take for you to feel secure enough so you don't need nuclear weapons? Now, that could be a pretty steep price tag, so we shouldn't commit to anything. But I think it'd be very useful if we could hear what it is, what it would take, so they feel they don't need nuclear weapons.
And our
I was overwhelmed when I was there. Well, Dave, just one more thought. When I went there, I, you know, studied the Korean Peninsula ever since I served there in the mid-'80s. And I was blown away by the magnitude and depth of the paranoia and siege mentality that prevails among the elite in North Korea.
Facts and fears, hard truths from a life in intelligence. Jim Clapper, so good to have you here. And thank you for coming to the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago.
Well, thanks, David, for having me. And it is great to be here. And I thoroughly enjoyed the discussion. Thank you.
And I would be remiss if I didn't say thanks for your half century of service to the country.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. For more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.